Hello and welcome to Open Door Films. My name is Andre Spenatar and I'm really excited about this episode today because I got to talk with a real rock star who works in the Bitcoin community. Now, as mentioned in prior recordings, I've talked about Bitcoin and its importance. I've mentioned several of the sponsors of this podcast and I've even dropped Bitcoin buying apps for everybody in case you want to get into Bitcoin. But the guest of my podcast today was Peter McCormick of What Bitcoin Did. I reached out to Peter about a week ago asking for a discussion, mostly about movies, because over the course of listening to his podcast, in addition to the educational aspect, his Bitcoin podcast is providing me an understanding of Bitcoin and the multitude of topics it can address. I've also noticed that Peter is an avid film fan and it was fun to talk movies with him, in addition to Bitcoin. I mean, I'll admit, I was a little muddled of how to talk about Bitcoin regarding film and cinema and the culture around it, but hopefully in a future episode, if I ever have him as a guest again, we'll be able to talk about it in greater detail. At the same time though, it was fun to talk with Peter about all sorts of movies and how much of an impact they've had on culture and just how great it is just to talk about movies for the sake of it, because I feel as a podcaster and as a lover of cinema and literature, I feel films have the ability to spark a multitude of conversations. Not just by how great they are or the type of the genres they focus on. I feel that the intellectual discussions and the questions that they can have us contemplate are what are integral and meaningful about them. And I got the sense of that with Peter, as I do with anybody else who wants to be a guest on this podcast. Because at the end of the day, this podcast, although it's centered on film, it's given me the opportunity to speak with people that work in different fields. And that's what I like, because I like listening to multiple perspectives. I mean, yeah, we're going to compare those. I'm going to try to compare those perspective to movies from time to time. But overall, I'm just a guy who's intellectually curious, and I was glad to share that curiosity with Peter in my discussion with him. Anyway, for those of you who are still a little unsure about Bitcoin, if you want to learn more about Bitcoin, check out Peter McCormick's podcast, What Bitcoin Did. It's probably it is the greatest podcast centering on Bitcoin ever listened to. I mean, a lot of other great podcasts like Stefan Libera, The Bitcoin Standard, The Orange Pill Podcast, and afterthought there, but in either case, check out Peter McCormick's What Bitcoin Did. Check out the films he's made, which you can find on whatbitcoindid.com. Check out his social media handles, support his show, and support my show as well, hopefully, because I do have a Patreon link as well as a few sponsor links and the Bitcoin buying links I've dropped down. Anyway, enough of my babbling. I hope you all enjoy my discussion with Peter. And enjoy the show. Okay, well, Peter, thank you for being on the podcast. And as redundant as it would be to ask you to let people know who you are, but I guess I asked this because I know there are still a lot of people out there that aren't familiar with Bitcoin and the importance of it. But would you mind just going through that and saying who you are and what your podcast is about?
Yeah, well, listen, thanks for having me on your show. It's nice to meet you. My name's Peter McCormack. I'm from Bedford in the UK, and I have a podcast which is primarily about Bitcoin, but we also get into things like macroeconomics, human rights, activism, all through the lens of Bitcoin.
That's great, because I've grown, in addition to the educational aspect of Bitcoin that I found very intriguing about it, I love that you've talked about a multitude of issues, and I recently listened to the episode you put on Monday regarding the politics then which Bitcoin is attributed to. And the reason I wanted to have you on the podcast is because, believe it or not, I think that in many ways Bitcoin could be impactful on film culture, not just from a financial standpoint, but from even just the tone within film. I mean, I don't know how to put this, but I guess over the past decade, just the tone of certain films have changed as a result of the economics within our environment, but almost like instinctively. Have you noticed something like that?
I haven't. I think the economics of films have changed in that it's very clear what is working and what isn't. There is a lot of superhero films, Marvel films, which aren't really to my taste, but obviously they're very successful. But also the nature of cinema has changed with COVID. You know, with COVID, people weren't going to the cinema. They were watching films from home. And you know, I don't know how distribution works, but we saw a lot of distribution straight to streaming services, straight, you know, Sky in the UK or you know, Apple Film. And you know, there's films now that come out in the cinema and they come out in the streaming services at the same time, or they come out a week later. And you know, I found myself paying £16, £20 to watch a film now at home in my lounge rather than going to the cinema, which I think is a shame. I like the cinema experience. I like going to the cinema. I cheat when I'm having a film at home, which I should be watching in the cinema. But I've noticed that has changed. And so there's also obviously this challenge that the streaming services are making their own films, like Netflix is investing heavily in developing films, Hulu and Amazon themselves. And so I just think at the moment that the whole nature of cinema is being disrupted. I don't know if there's a Bitcoin lens to it. I can't apply to it, but there's definitely an economics lens to it.
I guess this idea came from just, there's this podcast I listen to called Cinema of Meaning. And it's from this YouTuber called like Stories of Old. I don't know if you're familiar with his work, but there was an episode where they did one on 500 Days of Summer. And one of the criticisms they had of the film is that the tone of the film so feels so optimistically unfamiliar because it was made pre the 2008 financial crisis I've listened to so many Bitcoin podcasts and what I've learned is how much economics factors into human nature and human behavior. And pre-2008, there was a sense of optimism and how you could live your life to a certain extent that over the past decade and a half, I feel that films have gotten used to a more cynical, pessimistic lens of living in an environment that it's just become instinctive. I don't know. I guess I'll turn this to some films I'm really appreciative of. And the films I really love are the John Wick movies. And I've noticed in the John Wick films that they pay one another with this particular type of hard currency that you could say was ahead of its time in that it feels like Bitcoin in many ways, but.
Yeah, I don't know. I've not really thought about that. Look, like art imitates life, right? Mm-hmm. And so you would expect films to reflect culture. And if we are in more cynical times, then you would expect that. But also, films are a predictor of the future. I mean, at a time now where AI is growing, a lot of people are going back and watching the Terminator films. I got my son to watch Terminator 1 and 2, and we've got 3, 4, and the rest to go. And it, you know, some of the things that are predicted in there, people are saying, well, actually, could this now be a reality? I mean, we're talking about the potential for AI killing us all. And so, yeah, I don't know. My approach to film is I will just watch a film and judge it on its own merits. Like, do I enjoy watching this film? Have I enjoyed it? Yes. I'm not too worried about if the film reflects culture. I'm not worried if it's too optimistic or too pessimistic. I can happily watch I don't think about it that deeply. I'll happily watch a film and just judge it on its own merits.
I guess that was just my way of seeing things because I've just a pattern I've noticed throughout time, and maybe that's a result of other films and the impact they've had. I mean, it's been interesting you mentioned superhero films because I can tell you're probably a fan of a film like The Dark Knight, but ever since that film, many superhero films have tried to imitate what that film did by becoming either super serious or super political, even though the film wasn't trying to be political. It was just a consequence of the environment in which it was being made. But yeah, I think I agree with you that art imitates life, but I just feel that post the 2008 financial crisis, people have just become more cynical. And obviously the standard of living has decreased to an extent where I guess that's why we're seeing a lot of belief in our institutions crumbling.
Yeah. I mean, I love all three of The Dark Knight, The Dark Knight Rises. I love all three of those Batman films. The Christopher Nolan ones, I think they're brilliant. I'm not a huge fan of superhero films, but I think, ironically, is the ones I like are the Batman ones. He's not actually a superhero, is he? He doesn't actually have any special powers. He just has technology he uses, whereas all other superheroes actually have superpowers. So I think it's kind of ironic that the best one is the one where he's not actually a true superhero. I actually didn't even mind the most recent Batman, what would you call it? Remake or redux, the Batman.
It's like a reinterpretation. I mean, to be honest, I enjoyed it very much because it felt like a callback to old school cinema, especially the noir era. But what have you always, has the latest trend in superhero movies just made you more pessimistic about them? Because I've had that experience with Marvel in my own sense, because to be honest, the last time I was excited was when Avengers Endgame in 2019 came out, and that's before the big streaming boom we had as a result of COVID.
I've just never been a huge fan of superhero films. I like the very original Superman films, the original Clark Kent films, particularly Superman 2. And then, like I say, I like those three Batman films, but it's just not my category. I'm just not into that category of film. The only one I liked recently, there was one where it was like almost like a dark take on almost like a Superman, Brightburn. Whereas like this,
I haven't seen that.
Absolutely love that, because it was kind of like a take on Superman, but except the superhero was, you know, evil, like fundamentally evil. And that to me was just doing something a bit different. But Marvel films, I'm just not into. It's just not my thing. Like, I get why people like it, and those people like it seem to love it. I didn't mind Black Panther. I've got to say, I haven't seen the second one. I thought Black Panther was pretty good. It's just not my category of film. If I'm on a plane and I see a Marvel or a superhero film, I don't go to it.
I've kind of lost, in my case, my faith in them has slowly crumbled over time, especially when it's not just, I mean, it's hard to be too hard on them, because on one end, it's like a double-edged sword. Do I agree that they're kind of the Star Wars of our generation and in of this current generation in some sense? Yeah, and
maybe your generation, not mine. Star Wars was the Star Wars of my generation.
Well, I believe it or not, when I was a child, I mean, there was like this video cassette set series of the Star Wars films. One second. I'm getting a weird message here. I'm sorry.
It's all right. I mean, I saw Return of the Jedi in the cinema. That's how old I am.
Oh, sorry. It's fine. But yeah, like I was saying, there was like a, when I was a child, there was like a video cassette series of Star Wars in the Costco, and there was something about it that just drew me to it before I even knew what it was. And I don't know if you had a similar experience when you first heard of Star Wars as a child, but there was just something mythic about it that drew me to it automatically, that I can understand that. But when calling the Marvel the Star Wars of this current era, I guess in terms of the phenomenon, the effect it's having on culture, but I think it's reaching a point where people are just becoming either desensitized or just so accustomed to it that they're not even having to think about it anymore.
Well, the problem is these markets are so saturated now because of the streaming services. It's a bit like Disney has, you know, they've been making additional Star Wars films. They've then been making Star Wars series for the streaming services. And it's too much for me now. You know, I want to see the films and I'm good. I tried The Mandalorian and I was like, meh, you know, these things aren't really grabbing me. And I feel like that's the problem that's going on with the Marvel stuff. They're producing so many films, and it's just completely saturated, and it doesn't excite me. There's nothing new or interesting in it. It's almost like a formula that they've put together, which they know will work in the cinema. They will, you know, their ticket sales will be excellent, but I'm not into it. I have zero interest in Marvel films.
Well, I've lost interest also because I honestly think Because of the many technological advances that have been going on, people's attention spans have depleted, that they're just going to they'll adopt films that just don't really get them to think as much as, I mean, when's the last time you heard that somebody talking about The Godfather or something from Scorsese?
Well, look, in the circles I mix in, if we talk about films, things like Godfather will come up. We will talk about those types of films or old films. Also, I've got two kids, right? 13 and 19. So, the different ages they reach, I introduce them to old films. And my son has seen Casino, Goodfellas, Godfather 1 and 2. I've been through those with him. So I get to relive those films with my kids because I think they're important films to see.
Are you excited for the new Martin Scorsese film?
I am very excited for the new Martin Scorsese film.
Flowers of the Killer Moon. I mean, the book
Yeah.
by David Graham is fantastic. And I actually read his other book, The Lost City of Z, which was made into a film with Charlie Hunnam by James Gray. And that's a brilliant film, as is his other one, Ad Astra, which actually talks about just the impact technology has on our culture and where it could lead us into the future, but it could also make us more desensitized and even more less emotionally dependent on one another. I don't know how to put it. I mean, I feel that as technology has advanced, people have become more disconnected in many ways, and I think that's re reflected in a lot of good movies, but also just in the types of films we consume. Mean, do you feel that with the fact that people it's easier to consume films like the Marvel films, people are just that their attention spans and their intelligence is just kind of faltering a bit?
Well, you could say that, but you could go to any period in time and there'll be large commercial films, the big blockbusters that come out. And I mean, we've got Indiana Jones coming out. We've had, ever since I was a kid, we've had Indiana Jones films. There's always been blockbusters. But I think if you're interested in film, there are still good, independent films being made or interesting films being made. You just have to just have to go and look for them. But I just feel like for me, ever since COVID, we've had less films to be excited about. I always like Oscar season because you just get a menu of new films to go that you need to go and see.
Really? You
And
still have optimism for Oscars?
well, what I know is it's going to be because what you're going to have is you're going to have the nominations, but pre-nominations, you're going to have the different film journalists who are going to pitch what they think might be nominated. So you essentially have a huge list of films that they're going to be coming out that you can look through and go, well, what here am I interested in? Like I think the last Oscars was Belfast. I was interested in that film as an example.
Oh.
But it's just a way of like introducing me to a bunch of films that I've not heard of yet or might not know about that might be worth watching.
I haven't seen Belfast yet.
It's worth it. It's a good film.
I'm curious. My brother told me he saw it, and I mean, he didn't very much like it. But I've always had a fascination with the conflicts involving the IRA. I've seen several films involving it, like Daniel Day-Lewis and The Boxer, or even In the Name of the Father, which to me are very underrated films. I think they portray Irish culture in a very authentic way, and I guess. I hope I'm not coming off as pessimistic when I describe the way people consume films now, but I just feel that if you were to mention those types of films to the average person, they wouldn't know about it. Yeah, when I was a child, those were films I was constantly referred to. The irony.
Yeah, sometimes I think it just depends what circles you mix in and how into film you are. I'm like, if you're really into film, then you're going to go down the rabbit hole of finding good independent or unknown of films. I mean, I can watch seven films in a week sometimes and watch one every day. And so I'm always looking for films, but I always think there's this blockbuster commercial layer, and then there's this kind of like independent layer. And I think you can find what you want, but we are living in a culture which is more transient. We're living in a culture where people want instant gratification, and there is more money to be made making big blockbuster films. I think it's probably harder at the moment to get independent films financed, especially with what's going on with the economy. But there's always good films you can find now or from previous years. If you just go and hunt out on Google, you can find amazing films that have been made over the last decade that you would never have heard of. It doesn't bother me. Because that's them and their life and their choice. If people don't want to consume the kind of films I want to see, fine, that's their life. I still am in control of the films I want to watch and I want to see, and I'm happy with that.
In many ways, I think that there is an angle of Bitcoin regarding cinema, because ever since COVID and the way studios have been approaching how they make movies, you've seen a lot of filmmakers take on a much more decentralized approach of how they make movies. I mean, I'm not saying someone like Christopher Nolan has taken that, because he's still working with, I think he's working with Paramount in making his new film Oppenheimer, which I'm very excited
about. Wow. Yes. Very, very excited about.
But
because he had a bit of a...
He told Warner Brothers to go fuck themselves, essentially.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking more, you know, Memento was a great film. The Batman films were all fantastic. Inception was brilliant. And then I felt like he kind of peaked at Inception and kind of went downhill a little bit. Tenet, I applaud the ambition. It just didn't work, but I applaud it. And I've watched it 3 times now, you know, and each time you're I get still, more from it.
And you're still mind fucked?
Sorry?
You're still mind fucked?
I just think it was very, like, Inception was very ambitious, but you could follow it and you could understand what was going on, and it worked. The first time I watched Tenet, I felt like there was probably some arguments on the cutting floor, because some of the cuts didn't make sense to me. And then when you watch it and you're trying to follow exactly what's happening, you're like, well, where are they? Was that forward? It just didn't work as well. What was the space film he made? I forgot the name.
Interstellar.
Interstellar to me worked until the last kind of 10 minutes. It was just like, look, this is too crazy and weird. And so I feel like he needs to come back. And with Oppenheimer, it looks like a slam dunk. The only thing in the trailer that is like irking me is Matt Damon, because Matt Damon's playing Matt Damon. And, you know, we're here to save the world. It looked like too dramatic a claim. But I've got real high hopes for Oppenheimer.
Well, there was actually a recent article that Nolan made a comment about how Oppenheimer can be seen as a horror film. And
yeah,
in many ways, not just because of the idea of the atomic bomb, but are you a fan of comics?
No, I'm not a comic book guy. I think that's why I never really got into, like, I've never got into anime films. No, comics, animations, it's not my thing.
There is, granted, even as someone who isn't interested in comics, I think you would like the work of Alan Moore, because his comics are kind of like a deconstruction of comic book superheroes. Basically, they show the ugly side of it. And there's actually a clip of him in 2008 when they're asking him, and do you think the apocalypse is among us? And he actually said something interesting, that most people misinterpret the apocalypse as the end of the world. But then he said that you have to then think back, what does the world mean? It's a construct. And Oppenheimer gives a similar notion, because although we haven't dropped a nuclear bomb since World War II, just the existence of the bombs has changed our perception of the world. And just the psychological approach can work in a horror film. And I think in many ways, Oppenheimer is going to tackle that. But they're just, when it comes to a subject like that, and even the timing when the film is coming out, it's kind of ironic.
Because of the fact that we've had a war in Ukraine, Russia, where Russia are threatening to use nuclear weapons.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. And the scarier thing is that people have just gotten used to it. They're like, meh. In many ways.
Yeah. Well, maybe it's a good time for it to come out.
Yeah, maybe it'll raise some awareness, because I think it's not just the existence of the bomb that is terrifying. I think it's the fact that people have gotten so used to the existence of it that they've just become passive to the threat of nuclear war. I mean, I listen to Glenn Greenwald's podcast, and I hear him constantly talk about how this war has led us to that point. And I know you had him on your podcast over a year ago, and that was a great interview, very fascinating. But I guess I also compare it to the Snowden leaks, because the idea, you think that more people would be angry that the government listens to our phone calls and reads our emails illegally, and yet people have just gotten used to it as well, in the sense that they're passive.
Yeah. the nature of the world we live in. I think people are busy. They want to get on with their lives and don't want to be constantly thinking about the negatives and trying to live a positive life. So sometimes these negative externalities, they maybe just kind of try and ignore.
I don't want to be the guy who just raises a bullhorn, but I just think it's a fascinating angle. And I guess in many ways you could say, oh, Oppenheimer will do some, will probably hopefully bring some awareness to it. Because I mean, even in Christopher Nolan's worst films, you get at least, not to say that any of his are bad, they at least get you to think.
True, yeah, and that's what I think with like Oppenheimer. We could say it's like the timing's ironic, or I just think it's a fortunate timing to just remind the world of what actually happened during World War II and why the Americans rushed to build a nuclear bomb and what they did with it. And you know, it makes you question that. Well, I mean, it was an evil act to drop the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and you know, hundreds of thousands of people died. It was horrific. It was terrible, but it's ended the war. I mean, I've been on the warship where the peace treaty was signed in Pearl Harbor. Yeah, it's in Pearl Harbor. It was one of those real weird questions. Those real things you have to ponder. This evil act ended the Second World War. This evil act may have prevented a much longer World War II with even more deaths. It's a horrible thing to say. Well, is it good? Is it bad? I mean, it's bad, but were the outcomes good? It's, yeah, just you have to think about these things. And I think Oppenheimer will make people think again.
I think in many ways, the subject of Bitcoin does a similar thing, because I've noticed in some of your podcasts, you've posed the question of, as great as something as Bitcoin would be from a decentralized aspect, you also said you had pondered the idea that it might create a society of haves and have nots.
We already have one of those. Will it make it a worse society of haves or have nots, or better? You know, will the wealth gap increase or will the wealth gap close? Will those at the bottom, you know, will it make everyone richer? That's what you hope, is that everyone just becomes more wealthy and can protect their wealth. I think you can't be utopian about anything that you are championing. You have to really question yourself and question the implications of these things, because a Bitcoin-based world is probably going to be a very different world from the one we live in now. It's not going to be the same world, but we're spending Bitcoin. It's a different world.
No, that's for certain. I mean, any form of utopianism, it pretty much leads to anything Orwellian in a sense. I mean, I can't predict what the world will be like in 10 years if it becomes more hyper Bitcoinized.
Yeah, who knows, man? Who knows? But we're certainly at a time where everything else is a bit screwy. So I do champion Bitcoin. I do think it will bring some more sanity to the world, not just because of Bitcoin itself, but the way Bitcoin makes you rethink the world and rethink yourself. So that's what I hope.
I look at it as a way of flipping that old saying, time is money. I always felt they should be reversed, like money is time, because at the end of the day, when people say money brings you happiness, I think people misinterpret it as that, no, it provides you with a sense of optionality, because I think the idea of having options and just having less stress of how to approach those options is very healthy and something people would like to have. I mean, I once remember Jordan Peterson talking about how when you have too many options, it does create a sense of anxiety. But I guess that's just the angle I come at it from, because I feel that having a sense of optionality without the anxiety, you can look at Bitcoin in a similar sense.
I mean, you know, you can be paralyzed by options. You know, if you have too many options, it can be difficult. But I'm with you. I mean, look, American Hoddle said money is a proxy for time. You give up your time to earn money, and therefore, you know, you should be able to protect that wealth that you've earned. And if a government or a central bank destroys a currency, they're destroying your time, because you've given up that time to earn that money. I think it's a great way of looking at it.
What are your thoughts on Monero? Because I know you've discussed it in previous podcasts before, and I don't know if your views on it have changed.
No, I'm fine. But look, I mean, I don't mind if people want to use Monero. then cool. It's, yeah, there's a lot of cryptocurrencies out there, and there's a lot of shit coins and a lot of scams, but Monero to me is a technology that people have and are using, and they're using it for a specific reason, which is privacy. And achieving good privacy with Bitcoin is difficult. It just is. And so if somebody wants to use Monero, good for them. I don't mind.
I guess that's the only other cryptocurrency besides Bitcoin that I champion, in a sense, because I still don't understand, just like you, I don't understand the popularity of Ethereum. I look at it, I figure people would be more self-aware about something like Monero as something more efficient.
You look, people get into things and then they have a sunk cost in terms of their time and their investment and their belief structure. I mean, I care about a decentralized hard currency, and that's Bitcoin, and that isn't Ethereum. So Ethereum just has no purpose in my life.
Would you say Monero is decentralized in a sense?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, look, they're all decentralized to an extent. I just think the decentralization with Ethereum is weak. I think the decentralization with Bitcoin is strong, and I think Monero falls somewhere between the two of them.
That's a good way of looking at it. It's much more, I mean, Ethereum to me is just something that is fancy. It's a trend.
Yeah, it's a way of making money.
Granted, I'm not necessarily a big fan of the metaverse or the online game. I never could get into it. I don't know if you still play video games.
No, I'm too old for that stuff now. I mean, I do the odd one on my phone, Mr. Jump.
But you like games that are more story and campaign oriented, I take it.
I mean, historically, I mean, the first games, trying to remember the first games I ever played, Granny's Garden on the BBC, and I liked Manic Miner, which was a very old school platformer, Jet Set Willy, an old school platformer, Chucky Egg, when I got into the PlayStation. I mean, I was a big Grand Theft Auto fan. I thought those games were brilliant because they were so immersive. The freedom you had to just do whatever you wanted in those games was brilliant. But yeah, I don't have the time to spend gaming anymore. I don't have 10, 12, 15 hours a week to sit down and play Call of Duty or some adventure game. But I mean, if anything, because I don't have much time, I've gone back to the platform games on my phone. Mr. Jump, I like that. I like Mr. Jump.
Yeah, at least it's not that online community stuff, because I feel like that even adds to more disconnection within our culture. Because I tried playing Call of Duty online on Xbox once, and just the complete disconnect between the interaction and players just felt so hollow that it just automatically turned me off.
Yeah, but it's a different kind of community now. Like, we're pre-internet, because I don't know how old you are, but I remember there being no internet, no mobile phones. Your community was, within your small, tight geographic area. People have been able to find communities online, which are global, but people they relate to or can connect to. Yeah, I think that's a positive.
I mean, one of the first games that made me think about that sense of community were those Pokemon games, because believe it or not, the reason they always released two different versions was because some had excluded components in them, and it allowed players to trade and participate in battles, but they had to literally physically be near one another in order to do that with those Game Boys. They had to use these cables or these wireless adapter modules. So in a way, it was kind of like a positive form of communication. And I guess going back to film, I've always felt like talking about movies with fans of the classics, or just with the films that get you to think more on an intellectual level, allows me to feel like there is a sense of community in that. Because I think with just the trend of superhero movies that people make nowadays, that it's just more passive and more accepting.
Well, it's just not real world. It's hard to relate to. And I know sometimes they're trying to give a message, but it's superheroes. But again, I just don't watch them, so I find it hard to relate to them. Like, I found some of the especially in the Dark Knight, some of the questions it posed to you as a viewer were interesting. But again, to me, that's not a superhero film, because he's not a superhero because he doesn't have any superpowers. It's just a hero movie.
There is still a risk, because it can easily be accused of being an ideological film, as a film that's just presenting ethical questions. When that film came out, they felt that it was promoting some type of conservative or right-wing agenda.
Yeah, I think that's people perhaps overthinking it. sometimes, like I said to you early on, I mean, like, sometimes I just watch a film and enjoy it for what it is. Yeah, I don't have to overthink. What is the meaning of this? What is this trying to tell me about the world? What agenda is it pushing? Something like I can just watch a film and enjoy it on its own merits.
But it seems like that pattern has only increased since then. Like people nowadays are ready to jump to accuse a film of being guilty of any particular type of agenda.
But that's life. And I think that's more of an American issue because America's so polarized. I think maybe people are doing that. I'm not doing that here. And we don't really have that kind of polarization here. So we're not looking for trying to find meaning into films to say that is a conservative agenda or that's a liberal agenda. It's like, I think people are much happier just to watch a film and go, what does this mean to me as an individual?
Yeah, I wish people thought like that more because, I mean, I guess I became more familiar because you also mentioned the third Batman film, and that film got blasted as being pro-conservative to a point where it was not anti-populist, like anti-working class, which was just bizarre.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're seeing it talking about.
Well, you're talking about it, but like, be the change you want to see. You know, if you don't want to go down those rabbit holes, just judge it as a movie on its own. I thought the third one was okay. I thought there was some cool special effects. I loved the bit in the American football stadium. I thought Bane was a cool character, but to me, it was the worst of the three films.
But when I was earlier mentioning the John Wick movies and how they automatically make me think of Bitcoin, they don't just make me think about it from the fact that they in the films they trade in this hard currency that allows them to operate in a decentralized fashion. But I don't know if you've ever heard this theory that in many ways the John Wick movies are Matrix spin-offs as a new simulation, but in many ways. Bitcoin often goes, the idea of Bitcoin giving people a self-awareness of how money actually operates in our system, it's been compared to the pill moment in the Matrix in many ways. And I don't know what you're talking about.
I've never watched a John Wick movie. I've watched the trailers and it's just, again, it's not really my type of film. And I like Keanu Reeves as an actor. I think he's brilliant. I'm a huge fan of the original Matrix. I thought the new one they released was god awful, absolutely terrible.
Comparative sequels.
So I love that. So my main issue with the Matrix films is I don't enjoy the bits where they're actually outside of the Matrix in that kind of underground place. I can't remember what they call it, but when they're in the Matrix, I love those films. And I think at the time, like the first Matrix was a groundbreaking film, and. But that fourth one they released like a year, 2 years ago, I thought was, I mean, I stopped watching it. I managed about half an hour. I was like, this is truly dreadful.
Jesus. And I heard it actually did better than the two sequels. But the reason I compare Bitcoin and the Matrix, because I guess, I don't know if Max Kaiser has compared it in previous podcasts, but in many ways, when people adopt Bitcoin and they understand it, they get an awareness of how the entire banking system is just—it's just a narrative that's been sold to people, just like how the Matrix is about a system that is specifically designed to make you into just another component of it, rather than get you to think. And once you become more self-aware, you gain some control over your life. Just like how Bitcoin in many ways can do that within a crooked, would you say our financial system is inherently crooked or it's just so broken that?
No, it's inherently crooked. I mean, no, it's inherently flawed because of the incentives, and then there are crooked players in there abusing those flaws.
Well, the reason I think you'd like the John Wick movies because they're not just action films. They carry this meta narrative where there's a self-awareness that there is a deeper reality within the films. And you'll see the Bitcoin angle of how the characters in this secret world that is like the world underneath the false reality we live under. They operate with this hard currency that you don't know what it's worth, but it's certainly worth killing for, and it's certainly worth more than anything that's fiat based. They don't tell you how much of that currency there is, but it's clearly finite and scarce, just like Bitcoin.
Then I'm gonna watch them.
Oh yeah,
I'll start with the first one tonight.
Oh yeah, the first one. is a classic. I mean, personally, for me, the third one is my favorite so far, but I haven't seen the fourth one, so I can't say. I mean,
Right. Well, I'll watch them and let you know what I think.
oh yeah, I mean, I would definitely love to have you on another podcast episode dedicated to John Wick, because as I mean, because there's a part of me that still won't let go about that ridiculous theory that they're Matrix spin-offs. And I wouldn't you mind if I spoiled one thing about the third one for
Yeah,
you?
don't spoil them. Let me watch them and let me tell come back to you and say to you if I think they are spin-offs.
Okay, and it but ironically, they were directed by the stunt coordinators of the Matrix that trained Keanu Reeves, so.
Okay. Well, let me watch them and I'll give you my feedback.
Oh yeah, you'll definitely love them, because at first I was turned off because I wasn't a fan of Keanu Reeves at the time, because of, yeah, I've seen some of his goofier performances, but you
What, Bill
can't.
and Ted?
No, I'm not talking about Bill and Ted. He's brilliant there.
Yeah.
I'm talking about films like that, I guess Knock Knock, or I
Haven't
guess
seen that.
more of his romantic films, which kind of look
Yeah.
weird.
I wouldn't watch those. So, I mean, he's for me, he's Bill and Ted, he's Point Break, and he's The Matrix. That's like, and so he has a great record for me in making films I love.
What about Devil's Advocate? What did you feel about that?
Love that film, especially as somebody who's been involved in a 4 or 5 year lawsuit. That film to me, I absolutely love.
Jesus, can't imagine the stress of that.
Yeah. Fucking
But
lawyers.
well, I guess in the end of, I mean, I guess my only problem with Devil's Advocate was that moment where he starts screaming at Al Pacino, where he's kind of overdoing it. He's going for that Daniel Day-Lewis moment, but that's, I guess, what made me kind of laugh at some of his performances. But he's really good in John Wick. I mean, he doesn't have to say much, but those are great films, and maybe you'll start to think they are Matrix spin-offs, especially when you see some of the crazy shit they do, and just. Oh, you'll understand how I see the Bitcoin angle in there from the
Yeah.
self-awareness and orange pill thing. But are there any, I'm curious, who are your favorite filmmakers? Because you've mentioned Scorsese, and
I mean, it's very hard to get like not to start with Spielberg. Just an absolute genius filmmaker for decades has made just so many good films. I mean, made my favorite film, E.T. A film I love and I've watched endless amount of times and still get emotional watching. I think it's a perfect it's the perfect movie.
for
It's
the family.
flawless, but I think it's the perfect movie for anyone. To me, it's just a flawless film told brilliantly, and it grabs you and just takes you on a journey. So it's hard to look past Spielberg. Obviously a huge fan of Quentin Tarantino work, more his older stuff. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was all right. Didn't really love The Hateful Eight, but I'm a huge Jackie Brown fan, huge Reservoir Dogs fan. Love Pulp Fiction, although I don't think that aged particularly well.
Why not?
I don't know. I rewatched it again with my son, and I think it did a brilliant job at the time it was released. But some films I don't think age well because I think the style is innovative or interesting for the time it happens. Like Pulp Fiction was just so different when it came out. And now, if you try and watch it now, it's a great movie, it's a great story, but that kind of the style doesn't stand out as much anymore. And so, I tried to watch it, I watched it with my son, and I mean, he didn't bite on that at all. He's just, yeah, this is all right. But it was, like I say, at the time it came out, it was so different. I'm a huge Christopher Nolan fan. I think he's brilliant. But it's really hard to remember directors, unless they're some of the biggest directors. I tend to remember films more than directors.
No, I can.
Like I can't remember his name, but the guy who directed Whiplash and La La Land.
Oh,
I don't know his
Damien
name.
Chazelle.
Yeah, I mean, sorry, Whiplash is one of my favorite films ever. Again, another film I've watched so many times. I think it's a brilliant film, absolutely fantastic film. And even like La La Land, even though it's not my type of movie, because it was so well choreographed, it was just so interesting. But Whiplash blew my mind the first time I watched it. I was like, wow. I mean, that's kind of a horror movie.
Yeah, very horror. It is a horror movie. I mean, when I first saw it, I was surprised by how many people saw the ending as a positive ending, because I don't see it. I see it as a tragedy, because at the end of the day, even if he became successful, do you really want the approval of a psychopathic mentor like that?
Well, it's kind of like, to me, it reflects any abusive relationship where the abuser can still have control over you at any point. He almost has Stockholm syndrome, right? He's abused during that film by a horribly abusive person. But at the end, they question in the end, they did bring out that I mean, it's an incredible final scene.
Yeah, no question.
Incredible. And then they have that look at each other, and it's like they kind of that like realization they've been on that journey, and they could only do that by going on that journey. But at the same, so it's a bit like, where you question, we spoke about earlier, we question the nuclear bomb, ended World War II but killed hundreds of thousands of people. Like, how do you quantify whether that's a good or bad thing? This is a different scale, but it's similar. To get that performance required an abusive relationship. Is that a good or bad thing?
Yeah, especially when he's isolated, the boy was isolated as he was. You saw his relationship with his family. And
Yeah.
I mean, as someone who's a writer and who loves artistic stuff like that and can't really discuss it to the degree that I'm discussing with you, I've had those moments where you just feel like what you're saying falls on deaf ears, especially when they talk over you and want to discuss a different subject. But if you actually read the script, there's actually darker moments in there that you just think, yeah, this kid has become a puppet of that mentor. I mean, I don't know how much you really remember about the relationship he had with his father, but you could see that there was nothing there.
I mean, they just used to go to the cinema together, right, and eat popcorn.
No, pretty much, almost like it's habitual, but. And the father claims to love him, but it's more of like the natural concern a parent has, but where they want the best for their child, but they don't truly understand what's going on in their mind.
Yeah. Let me ask you about a film, because there's one film that I get a lot of people to watch. I don't think it's a great film or a terrible film. But it was a film I had, when I got to the end of it, I had no idea what I watched. And then I read the write-up. I was like, huh. And I had to rewatch it again straight away. Mother, the Darren Aronofsky film. By the way, another director I love.
Well, before I tell you my thoughts on it, what are your thoughts? Because there are so many diverse opinions on that film, what it's arguing, that I'm just curious on your interpretation.
Well, so when I watched it and I got to the end, I was just like, what just happened? What happened? Because I hadn't seen it at all as a story it was, right? I was just like, I have no idea what just happened. And then obviously I read about it, and and I understood that this was like the story of Mother Nature and God and yada yada and Bible stories. And but it all but I but the way it kind of st for me, it was telling the story of the evolution of humans from Adam and Eve through to where we are right now, and how we are, how we've basically committed every sin that we weren't meant to commit, and we're destroying the planet, yada yada. And so I think it did that really well. I get confused. There's bits that confuse me in it. But to me, it was just a really brave, crazy film to make. When he must have written the premise and taken it to the studio. I mean, only Darren Aronofsky gets to make that. A new director doesn't get to make that film.
Well, have you seen the original posters of the movie Mother? Not the one with Jennifer Lawrence holding the harp, but there's actually one that's silhouetted like the last shot of Apocalypse Now, where Colonel Kurtz is saying the horror, the
Let me have a
horror.
look.
The poster is framed like that, and although Apocalypse Now and Mother have totally different are totally different films, they do focus on one thing, the bottomless malice of the human being. And it's strange. When I talk about the bottomless malice of the human being, I don't mean it in a sense where they're openly being malicious, because even with good intentions, and it's interesting you bring up Oppenheimer, you think to yourself, even when human beings have good intentions, they accomplish some of the worst evils imaginable. And when they get used to it, they even indulge in the after in the results of it. And obviously, I guess from the biblical angle, Javier Bardem is clearly God.
Mm-hmm.
Then everybody else, and Jennifer Lawrence,
and she's Mother Nature, right?
Mother Nature or Mother, I guess Mother Earth, because I heard there was like a climate change angle from it. Although I would never, mm-hmm. And I listened to an interview Aronofsky made, but he doesn't sound like he's one of those pro climate change fanatics. He just has an awareness like you do that, yeah, humans have had an impact on the climate, but
I didn't see the climate change angle. To me, this was all about human nature.
Yeah, well, I get a similar feel from, did you ever see that film from last year, Don't Look Up?
Yes.
Leo DiCaprio. I never saw a climate change angle from that. I saw it just more like the current state of humanity, how we're just muddled with so much information that we're just either easily distracted or we just can't get to establishing a critical point or just a clear point of what we're talking about. That it's just...
Yeah. It was like, just about how vapid we are as humans.
Like, say you wanted to go on a major mainstream news network to talk about something important, whether it was Bitcoin or any other important subject, they would probably just try and get the simplified version from you because that's all they want. And even if you did go on a speech where you gave something more complex, they'd probably edit it so it's much more easy to process and it would turn off more people rather than get them to think.
That's fair. Yeah.
I mean, I remember it's interesting that you brought up the war in Ukraine. I remember your interview with Scott Horton. I'm sure if that was broadcast on CNN, they would just take the snippets that would probably make Scott look like a fanatic rather than a person who had something to say.
Yeah, that is also fair. Yeah, I took Don't Look Up as just a reflection of how vapid we are as humans, of what we've become, how meaningless we've become, and our intentions are so selfish and shallow. That's what it was. It was about the shallowness of the human existence right now.
Yeah, and how it's just escalated to a point where we can't even establish a sense of clarity as to who's actually telling the truth or has good intentions, or how most people just don't really have just become desensitized to the idea of constant disaster.
Yeah. I can't disagree with you on that.
I don't think that's Adam McKay's best film. I think, I would say that The Big Short is his best film. And even before I understood how inherently crooked our financial system was, I think it had something to say, but in a way where it wasn't shoving an agenda. I know you've mentioned in previous podcasts that one scene from the end with the family in the car, and that is a hard scene to process.
Very hard scene to process. So The Big Short to me is a brilliant, brilliantly directed movie because it shows you everything that's happening and it makes it exciting. Mm. It makes a financial apocalypse exciting. And then it just smacks you right in the chops at the end when you see the reality of it. And you're just like, fuck. So just like the ending was just like, shit, this is awful.
And the worst part is we're going to keep on doing it and doing it because
of course.
I feel that I've heard many people say that at the moment we're currently like at the next 2008. I don't know how you feel about that when something's going to break, but I personally think we're at a point where eventually when it comes to what the Fed is doing, we're going to reach that point.
Yeah, I think we are, and there'll be another movie to be made.
I mean, Matt, but Vice, when it comes to another film like Vice, to me, that's a more horrifying film. Not Adam McKay's best, but...
I didn't enjoy Vice.
Did you feel that it just had something to say about why we're in the state that we're in as well?
You know, I don't remember it well because I remember not enjoying it. So I can check out of a movie if I don't really enjoy it. Vice just didn't work for me.
Yeah, well, did you ever see... I know you mentioned you're not a big fan of superhero films, but I wouldn't say Joker is a superhero film either.
No, it's not, and it's a brilliant film. Absolutely incredible film. Like, again, completely blew my mind.
The timing was also ironic because it came out right before COVID, and even though it can't necessarily be related to COVID, all the stuff that happened during COVID just fit perfectly with it in many ways. I mean, society, just constant rioting, a lot of institutional failures, a lot of crumbling faith in institutional favor. Oh God, a tongue twist, but.
Well, if you look at the crumbling cities, the rising crime, what's happening in California with people just openly robbing stores, that to me, that is what the Joker represents, that crumbling, that fracturing of society, the fabric of society just collapsing. That's what the Joker represents to me, and you see that at the end, like the revolution starts.
And I mean, do you believe there's been a romanticization with that character because of a film like that, or even The Dark Knight, given that this idea of the anarchic extremist?
I mean, I could see how somebody did. For me, it was a character I had a lot of empathy for. It was a somebody who was struggling to find his place in a world which celebrates, certain characteristics of, which can make you a successful human. And and he's just somebody who struggles to find his place in that world and ends up getting humiliated. I have empathy with the character, not his, final
No, exactly.
decisions, but I have full empathy with him as a character. This is a tough world, and not everyone can live the life that's advertised to us on Instagram.
No, not at all. And when you think about it, even the film, how it questions the nature of our institutions and how they're inherently broken, and they're only sustained by an agreed sense of civility. That scene where he's in the talk show, he basically points out, okay, I can't tell this joke, but you only determine what is right for me to say, because he does tell a very crude and inhumane joke. But the irony was, the people that told him he can't say that are also justifying the kind of cruelty they demonstrated towards him when they played that skit of his just to openly humiliate him, where they commodified him. And there's an irony there. And I guess the reason I asked you if you think that archetype has been romanticized is because for someone like you who loves The Godfather and films like Goodfellas, the gangster has been romanticized. And I've always thought that was because we live in an inherently broken system, that there's something rebel-like about them, even though they're not necessarily glorified.
Well, we like the baddies. Yeah, the baddies are all, usually the interesting character. Darth Vader's interesting in Star Wars. Boba Fett's interesting.
Both, really?
Don't think Boba Fett's a cool character?
Oh, I think he's cool, but interesting, because from what I remember, he didn't have, unless you,
He's
because you
just a badass that just comes in and out of the film. You're like, who is this guy? He's cool.
Oh, I thought that because you mentioned you've noticed they've made a lot of Star Wars shows, they've added more dimension to him.
Yeah, I'm not interested in that. That's the point. I don't want that dimension to him. I liked him as this kind of like secret character, like a mercenary for hire. That's what he felt like within the original Star Wars films, and that's all I wanted for him. I didn't want depth to him. I didn't want to know about him. That's not, so I was not interested in that. But we like the baddies. Baddies are interesting. We're like rebels. I'm not sure when I watch Casino or Goodfellas or The Godfather, I'm romanticizing them as characters. I'm just enjoying the story of what these people do.
I guess I mentioned that because when you watch those characters operate, you know that they have awareness of how broken the system is, that the straight and narrow, the conventional ways of living don't really work and help you survive. Not necessarily.
I don't agree with that. I think they've just found an edge. I think a criminal has made a decision that I think cr most criminals are businessmen who've spotted an opportunity, but are happy to operate their business outside of the law. A lot of them may have been successful businesses with inside the law because they're entrepreneurial. These people are entrepreneurial, but they're just entrepreneurial outside the agreed norms of society, or the the legal structure of society.
Which do you prefer, Goodfellas or Casino?
Oh, Casino all the way. I think it's a far superior film.
Why? Because I always feel that people, because one of the common criticisms is that it's just Goodfellas 2.0. And I agree with that.
Yeah, no, it is. But also, yeah, that we have had Terminator 2 was better than Terminator. Aliens was better than Alien. We can have like six better sequels. I just think it was a better told story, better acting, more dynamic characters. If I watch them back to back, I'm just going to enjoy Casino more.
Definitely more expansive in terms of the scope, I guess.
Yeah.
I guess I've always had a fascination with Vegas and those shots of the desert. I don't know. That's just beautiful. Just that would be a great place to go to and just check out for yourself. Have you ever been to Vegas?
Yeah, a bunch of times. Love it. Old town, new town. Love it. Big Vegas fan.
What do you feel about Raging Bull, though?
I mean, it's a great film. You know what? I haven't seen it in a long time. I probably haven't seen it since my dad sat me down to watch it when I was a teenager. So I probably need to rewatch it with my son because, yeah, I know it's a great film. I remember it being a great film. I probably at the time wouldn't have appreciated it as much as I should have because I was a teenager. If I sat down and watched it with my son now, I'd probably appreciate it more and he would appreciate it less. But that's a good reminder. That's a film I need to watch with my boy.
Yeah. For me, I have to watch it every couple of years because it feels like an emotionally exhausting film because at the end of the day, you're sympathizing with a guy who isn't very sympathetic.
Hmm. Yeah. See, I don't remember the detail. Like I say, I probably watched that film nearly 30 years ago. Hard to remember that.
I was a much younger age than when I saw it. I saw it when I was 18 years old, and it actually broke me a bit because at the end of the day, horrible as the guy is, everybody has been at that low point in one moment in their life where they're just bashing their head against the wall, not physically, but metaphorically, probably. And you empathize with that.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to go back and watch that one with my son after I've watched the John Wick movies.
Oh, yeah. You're going to, I guarantee you're going to find the crazy. I am crazy. So the things I'm proposing will naturally sound ridiculous, but I think you will probably see the Matrix and Bitcoin angle from where the films go, because I think in many ways they do similar things that sci-fi films do. They're ahead of their time because the guy I told you about earlier, Alan Moore, he once said that one misconception about science fiction is they think you're talking about the future. You're not. You're talking about the present.
Yeah, that's also true. What's your favorite film?
There Will Be Blood. God, that's tough because there's actually two really good ones. And Chinatown and There Will Be Blood go head to head. And yes, they do reflect the evils of capitalism, but I just like the performances by the care and the complexity of those characters that seems somewhat so effortless. I mean, have you seen There Will Be Blood?
Yeah, of course. Love that film. But I love everything Daniel Day-Lewis has done.
Yeah, it's a shame he's not acting anymore.
Yeah, and it's a shame he's made so few films. You know, even his last movie, was it The Phantom Thread?
Yeah.
Okay. I thought, what a weird film to have as your last film. And if it's not Daniel Day-Lewis, I probably don't enjoy it that much because it's Daniel Day-Lewis. Yeah, I was just watching his character. I was just enthralled by it.
And one of the characters he plays, especially with There Will Be Blood, you could see that there's something deeper inside, but you just can't point. I always feel Daniel Day-Lewis, charming as he is in interviews, I feel that there's a mystery to him you'll never understand.
Because I mean, he's the greatest ever actor, if you ask me, that's ever lived. His performances are just insanely good. Gangs of New York, My Left Foot. The Phantom Thread was just it's almost like he puts so much into these performances they kind of drain him.
Now, that's what I heard that drained him, Phantom Fred. He wasn't intending that to be his last performance, but over the process of the film, that's what eventually broke him.
Yeah, I can understand that.
But again, when I say that there's a mystery to him, because the dedication I've heard he shows in all these performances, because I heard when he was doing Lincoln, he was even texting back and forth as if he was Abraham Lincoln, talking in the way in the text, like as if he was Lincoln. I always feel he does it in a way where it's so effortless. Yet with other actors, there would be a lot more attention. I mean, I remember before Christian Bale went on to play Batman, there was a lot of publicity about the amount of weight he lost for that film of his. He did The Machinist, where he's
Machinist. Yeah. Well, he lived on an apple and a can of tuna a day.
Yeah. And cigarettes as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, his appearance in that film is shocking. I like that film. It reminded me a little bit of Jacob's Ladder, and I don't know why. I've never been able to figure out. It kind of had the same kind of mood.
Oh, what's Jacob? I mean, without spoiling anything, what is Jacob's Ladder about? Because I'm going to see that soon, because I've seen
it. Just go watch it. Just go watch it.
I'm currently watching American Sniper because when I first saw it, I was surprised by the controversy around it, because I think it's much more complex than people realize than promoting the sniper, who was a controversial figure. But again, when you look at any controversial figure, you have to realize that there's a lot more complexity to them to just label them as bad or good.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Did you ever see the film with Bradley Cooper?
Sorry, which one?
American Sniper. It's the sniper Chris Kyle.
Let me check it out. I feel like I have. Let me see. Oh, yes. Yes, I have seen this.
It was directed by Clint Eastwood. And although I wasn't a fan of The Mule, I found it entertaining.
Yeah, The Mule was okay. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I've seen American Sniper.
And what were your thoughts on it at the time?
American Sniper?
Mm-hmm.
I'm struggling to remember it. You know, I think we're talking about possibly a film that means more to you, so you remember it more, rather than like a film that means a lot to me. So it's hard to remember the films you know, you're not that into.
I guess just the attention about it was more attractive to me than the film itself, because I only saw it once, and at the time I was just amazed by how much controversy it was attracting, as though it was promoting some agenda, when I thought it was the opposite. I thought it was just analyzing a character, who the circumstances around that character and what made him who he is. Because on one end, you have people that defend him and call him a patriot. And then, yeah, the other end, you have people saying he was a psychopath in many ways.
Yeah. I mean, you're giving me films now that I need to go back and rewatch and think about, because they're obviously films that mean a lot to you. And so I've not thought about them deeply. So like films that mean a lot to me, it's easier for me to talk about, but it's less easy if it's a film that means a lot to you. And it hasn't to me. Do you see what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Sorry about that. But
that's fine.
What films are the most meaningful to you, if you don't mind me asking?
Gosh. I mean, lots in different ways. I really like a film called It Follows.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. That to me, because I was a big Freddy Krueger fan. Loved the Wes Craven Nightmare on Elm Street's. I loved a lot of old horror films. And then horror went through this kind of like, felt like almost like a 2-decade period of just two boys, two girls. They go somewhere. One of the boys is a nerd. One of the boys, one of the girls are fucking and go off. And it's just the same formula. And eventually they all get picked off. And very little deviated for that. You know, that interested me that much. You know, Scream was kind of interesting when it first came out, especially when you rewatched that film. And I know what you did last summer was kind of interesting. I liked the first Final Destination. Saw was different, but It Follows was the first film I would say since I was a kid, whereas a horror film, I was like, just like blown away. I was like, wow, it's incredible. Yeah, I'm on edge the whole time. And I think it's that neat trick they played where anybody walking at any point in that film, you know, can be the spirit, the killer, the whatever. And I was, and it just grabbed me. And it's a film I must have watched like 20 times now. So that film means a lot to me in that somebody almost reinvented horror. They came back and said, like, made a proper horror film, which I thought was brilliant. So I love that film. E.T., I've mentioned to you, which I think is just the perfect movie. It's just a brilliant, brilliant film. Toy Story 4 is a curveball I'll throw in there. Because it's the only kids kind of Disney Pixar film that has ever introduced real tension. You know, the moment where they're all in with the claw, and they're all in the machine, and the claw's coming down to get them.
Is that the third one?
No, I think it was the fourth one. Was it the third one? I thought it was the fourth one.
I've seen the fourth one, so unless they did something,
it might be then it might be the third one. You know, that was a genuinely terrifying moment in a Disney Pixar movie where you're like, well, you're on edge. It was emotional. Like when they reached out and they all held hands, I'm getting like goose pimples now. You're like, this is incredible. They've managed to do this in a Toy Story. And so I was particularly impressed with that. I loved Reservoir Dogs when that first came out, just because it was just so exciting for me as a kid, because it was just so wild. There's a film called Shotgun Stories, which is my curveball independent kind of film.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, it's well worth watching. But I like those kind of, you know, middle of nowhere America films. Yeah. What was the Jennifer Lawrence one that she made?
Winter's Bone.
Yeah, Winter's Bone. That kind of movie, that kind of middle of America.
Carries a certain rawness to it that just makes you feel that these characters are more authentic. You don't feel like they're acting. They're just being.
Yeah.
I say the same about The Place Beyond the Pines with Ryan.
Yeah. Dude, that's a great film. I mean, that's my favorite kind of genre of film. Like, I can't give it a name, but those kind of like forgotten towns in the middle of nowhere in America and telling the story of the people who live there. So yes, The Place Beyond the Pines, like Winter's Bone, Shotgun Stories. Yeah. Even Mud a little bit. I love those.
Oh yeah, Mud.
Those types of films I love. I also I do like sci-fi. I did love Ad Astra. I thought that was brilliant. I loved Event Horizon, though the film freaks me out.
I feel like such a doofus because I'm the only person among my group of friends who has not seen Event Horizon.
Dude, that's your homework from this. I'm going to watch John Wick. You have to watch Event Horizon.
Deal. Next time we do, if we do another interview, I've seen Event Horizon by then because I would love talking movies with you. And it's just, I mean, it's just great to speak with someone I've admired in the 2 years I've been watching your podcast because you could say I'm a podcast addict, but that's because I manage to incorporate listening to a podcast while I'm doing anything, whether it's for my own writing or just even while I'm working out. This morning, I was listening to a Joe Rogan podcast where he had this woman who is an expert on psychedelics. And just by the way, you listened to that one?
So I'm halfway through that. She's a bit older, isn't she?
Yeah, but she's got this grandmotherly feel to her. You think you never
would tripping.
Jesus. I mean, my personal favorite Rogan one was the one he had with, I guess, Georges St. Pierre. I mean, I train in martial arts and I'm a fan of a lot of martial artists. And I really don't like it when people make fun of people who like MMA in a sense where every fighter is a lughead. But when you look at these interviews, you see that they're deeply philosophically inquisitive men. I'm still hoping for Rogan to have Conor McGregor.
Yes.
Because I'd like to know. I just want to get inside his head and figure out what's going on in there.
Yeah, I want to see him interview Conor McGregor so much.
What do you think about his transformation? Because there's just something about it that's just changed the image of how people perceive him.
I think he's a troubled character, and I liked flawed characters. But it, you know, he was a, and I'm half Irish. You know, I've got my father's Irish. My father lives in Ireland, so you know, we massively celebrate any Irish success. It's a small island nation. I think what Conor McGregor did was to come up from out of nowhere and become the biggest star in MMA. It was incredible for him and his family, the people of Ireland. But I now think he's a troubled character,
Do you think
and
that's
I
a
worry for
success? Do you think that's a result of his success?
him. Perhaps, yeah, or just poor judgment. You know, I mean, I have a small amount of success. It's like minuscule amount compared to him. But even then, sometimes your feet lift off the floor, and you can suddenly have bad judgment. And I think he has bad judgment sometimes, which is sad for him. And I just hope he doesn't screw it all up somehow. Because like in the end, money doesn't ever actually make you happy. It just becomes, it just sets a new bar for you. Like your happiness comes from in the end. And I know that sounds really kind of like, you know, cliche and cringy, but it does. You know, money just enables you to do things, but like you could be the richest guy in the world and still unhappy. So I think he's such an interesting character because he's flawed, but I just hope he doesn't screw his life up.
I have a similar approach to the writer Charles Bukowski because he once said that money is magic, but he was just such a flawed and cynical guy, but he was so accepting of it that you just couldn't look away from him. He was like one of those writers that it took him a while to become successful, but he had this fuck it attitude that you just can't help but admire it because at least he could see some success in failure. Because
Yeah.
we live in a culture that just promotes the idea of success so much that it's no wonder people suffer from so much depression and anxiety rather than just saying,
Course.
fuck it. I mean, I know you said you're not a big anime fan, but what there's a an anime called Cowboy Bebop, and the main character, Spike, he just has this attitude that's just like whatever happens, happens. I mean, there are moments where he's basically about to be killed while he's riding his ship, and he's just like. And when he's told on the other end that his engines are fucked, and he just says, he just pulls out a cigar and he's like, whatever happens, happens. And I guess I get that feel from Bukowski. And I guess, and he was a, and if you watch any of the documentaries on Charles Bukowski, you see a very flawed, cynical, pissed off man, fucked up face too.
I'll check him out. Well, I do. Anyway, it's so nice to talk about something other than Bitcoin.
Does it become exhausting with all, because I figure that because Bitcoin has allowed you to talk about a lot of other topics other than just the month, the how it.
But I don't like being interviewed about Bitcoin. When people ask to interview me about Bitcoin, I don't want to do it. I don't think I'm very good at talking about it. I think I'm a good listener and a good at asking questions. You know, my passions are film and football. And so when you reached out and said, "Do you want to come and talk about film?" It's like, yeah, I'd love to do that because it's what I'm passionate about. I'm not passionate about Bitcoin. I'm passionate about people, you know, having
You like the
not having their money
opportunity.
stolen. Yeah, and I just I'm the thing about Bitcoin is I'm passionate about what it could mean for people. I'm passionate about Bitcoin itself. It's more of a mission, you know, it's a duty. Whereas film is a passion, football's a passion. So a chance to talk about this is, for me was great. So I appreciate you asking me.
Oh, absolutely. Because when it comes to film, it's not just that I'm passionate about film, I'm more passionate about the discussions that certain movies and books can promote in people's ability to think. Because I hope I don't come off as pessimistic, because I've mentioned that I feel that
A little
today,
bit, but that's fine.
but I just feel that today people, if you ask people if they've seen a film like The Godfather and any of the great works, and I know that depends on the inner circles, but I feel that people are less inclined to gravitate towards subject matter, towards films of either a similar subject matter or of the ability to get you to think more.
But that may be a generational thing because some of the films that my dad probably wished I had seen, I didn't because they're too old.
Such as.
I mean, I don't know. You'd have to ask him what films he liked that came out in the 60s and 70s. I'm a 80s and 90s kid, right? Some late 70s films. What I'm saying is a generational 30s, thing.
40s.
No. But what I'm saying is it's a generational thing. You know, that, and I think the things that my sons probably love from his generation, his kids might not get it so much. I just, because there's such a disconnect between the time that this, how the films look. I mean, remember how good The Matrix looked when it first came out? It doesn't look that great anymore.
No, look at and Batman Begins. Compared to The Dark Knight and The Dark Knight Rises, they operated in a smaller environment, but that worked for the what was influencing it at the time.
They were filmed a couple of miles from my house.
Which ones?
The Batman films. They were filmed in Cardington Hangars, which are about a half a mile from my football club.
Oh, that's awesome.
Isn't that wild?
Oh, yeah, that is crazy. I mean, but I guess when I was saying that Batman Begins feels very outdated compared to the other two, it's excusable because I know you say you're not a fan of comics, but the comic it was based off was a Batman comic where he operates in the slums, but he's like young, 25. He's a 25-year-old and he's starting out. So it makes sense within that film. And then The Dark Knight, Dark Knight Rises, you see a bigger scope of the cities they use, like Chicago, LA, and obviously a bigger budget. So,
yeah, look up Cardington Hangars. They filmed a lot. They made a lot of big films there because these are airship hangars, and so they're huge. But so many films have been shot there. But yeah, Christian Bale filmed less than a mile from my football club.
Oh God. I mean, I guess the Batman fan in me wants to ask, who is your favorite Batman? Because everybody has their different take.
Oh, let me get the list, because that's a good question. List of... So the only reason I struggle with Christian Bale is I always found his voice annoying.
The throat cancer.
Yeah, I just found it annoying. It's such an interesting question, because I didn't like his movie, but I didn't mind Michael Keaton as Batman.
Really? You're the first person, because you grew up around Batman. You probably saw it in theaters.
But it's probably because I like Michael Keaton as an actor so much that I'm like giving him the time of day. I mean, look, probably Robert Pattinson if I had to really pick, because it's the modern Batman, but his voice wasn't annoying like Christian Bale. Christian Bale's voice was annoying. I thought that's the only flaw of the film.
It's very strange because Christian Bale was the first legitimate Batman I saw in a theater, because I'd never seen the original Keaton Batman films until later on, and I never saw them in movie theaters because I was too young. And sadly, the first Batman films I saw in theaters were the Joel Schumacher ones, which were ridiculous.
Yeah.
And I guess I learned to love the voice in that sense. And granted, the last two, they kind of overdid it, especially when they amplified it. I thought Ben Affleck was okay as Batman, but unfortunately,
I don't think I've ever seen his Batman.
They didn't. If you watch it, you can tell they didn't know what they were doing with it. They had a good, semi-good start. The idea of a Batman that started killing people because he just got tired of the shit. But they really missed the mark. And the way they defended his murders was kind of absurd too.
I don't think I'll watch it.
Well, if you ever do see Batman versus Superman, watch the 3-hour cut. The 2.5-hour cut makes no sense.
I don't see myself giving 3 hours to that.
Nah. When I first saw, well, if you ever do, just watch the first 5 minutes and just say, I can turn my brain off and not give a fuck. That's the feeling I got when I saw it in theaters, because I don't know how you felt about Man of Steel. I think it is a unique film that promotes a lot of conversations. I think Henry Cavill is the closest actor to look like Superman.
Mm-hmm. He looks like Clark Kent.
Unfortunately, he's not going to get that chance anymore, which is sad because it was like a wasted amount of potential.
Yeah, again, I'm not a huge superhero movie film, so like it's just not something I would be drawn to.
I don't know what films don't. I don't know what films I'm against seeing. I guess romantic comedies, unless it's the rare exception.
I'm not a romantic comedy. Like, give me sci-fi. Give me a modern horror like Smile or It Follows. Give me middle of nowhere film in America. Give me anything by Fincher, Darren Aronofsky, and Nolan. That's pretty much where I am.
Well, in terms of romantic comedies, there are some that are like the anti-romantic comedy, which are interesting. Don John with Joseph Gordon-Levitt is a perfect example of a film that shits on the romantic comedy.
Well, you've already given me a long list of films that I need to go work through.
It's not obligatory. Don't worry. I just throw shit out there, and I'm glad. I was surprised though that this is the first time you're happy not to talk about Bitcoin. I mean,
happy not to talk about Bitcoin. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Do you feel because of the success of your podcast and the work you do with Bitcoin, you have to be? There's a part of you that feels like you're trying to sell it, not intentionally, but
no, not that. It's just when something takes up so much of your life, I don't want Bitcoin to be my identity. And it has become part of my identity, which I can't avoid because that's what I do. But I don't want it to be. I want to be a little bit more dynamic than that. And so, yeah, I have to eject myself from the world of Bitcoin and go into other worlds like my football world or, you know, my world as a father just to have a break from it.
No, when it comes to me, because even though I'm not ingrained in the world of Bitcoin like you are, I've come to understand what it represents, that whenever I get the opportunity to tell people about it, I feel like I'm just hitting against the wall because people just don't understand. And I've seen the damage, the lack of awareness of our system has had.
You
that
can't do it, dude. You can't do it. You just people will get Bitcoin at the time it suits them, when it's right for them. You cannot make it happen what you want to happen. You cannot force people.
I know, but it's like I guess I compare it to, like, imagine you're driving and you see somebody and their car breaks down. You want to help them, but then they tell you fuck off.
Yeah, you gotta leave them to it, dude. Leave them to it. They will discover it at the time that's right for them.
Oh, absolutely. And that's just the great, I mean, despite how significantly it's gone down, I just think that's an opportunity. That's still an opportunity for people to understand why it's so efficient, especially with many things that have been happening around it. I mean, the trucker convoy, I think, was one of the most significant things to educate people on why the adoption of it is important.
Yeah. And look, those people get it now, and great for them. And people in Argentina, massive inflation, they get it now. It's great. Like, you know, Bitcoin will come to people at the time they need it, not the time we think they need it. When the time it's a tool that recruits people during times of crisis, and that will continue to happen.
Yeah, well, I don't. That's just something that worries me. What is the event that will trigger a mass awareness of it? Because,
but it doesn't have to be a mass awareness. It can just be gradual adoption, and mass adoption probably wouldn't be good. You want gradual adoption, because the protocol itself has to grow alongside usage. So I think Bitcoin's adoption today has been perfect.
But even in the event of a CBDC, because the fact that their Fed is now seriously talking about it, but not where they're just throwing the idea.
Yeah, I don't know. I still don't know if that's going to happen, if they can practically deliver it on the technology. That's a big conversation, probably for another day, but I don't see it. I don't see it in the short term. I'm not too worried about that.
Are you relying on the government's incompetence? Because I know you've mentioned in an episode.
Well, I don't have to rely on anything. I hold Bitcoin. I'm a Bitcoiner. But I expect incompetence.
Rather than just pure corruption. I mean, there's a mix of that. Because I guess I see both angles. Because another guest I'm planning to have on my podcast, or hoping to, because I'm going to be speaking with him, he used to work in the FBI, because I like talking to people of multiple factions just out of intellectual curiosity. And I'm not that guy who feels that, even in film where the FBI and CIA have had like kind of a negative look, I don't believe that people who work in those institutions are all bad or all good. It's a mix.
No.
It's chaos.
Yeah, that's fair. I'm really sorry. I've got to go on to another call at 4 o'clock
Oh,
UK
no.
time.
Don't
So I've
worry.
got like a couple of minutes. I've really enjoyed this and I would love to do it again. Yeah, I have to go and do another call, man.
Well, don't worry about it, Peter. I was grateful you gave me the time. And listen, I'll include all the handles to your show. That way people know
Yeah, please.
more about that. And I'll share the links to my show, because I mean, it was great to talk of a guy who loves movies as much as you do, and who just, I mean, to me, you're a rock star with what you've done with 15 minutes.
Shut up. Well, listen, let me go and check out the John Wick movies and I'll get back to you and we'll circle back and do this again.
I'll check out Jacob's Ladder.
Yes, my man, you do that.
Take it easy, Peter.
Great to meet you, man. You take care.
Take care.